Hello, welcome and thank you for joining us and listening to our podcast, The God Beyond the Bible. Our podcast is released weekly each Friday. The content of each episode is based on the questions and curiosities we all have about God and the Bible. Many of our topics are considered taboo in the minds of the mainstream church. You will find our discussions to be, I think, refreshing and often far from traditional. But we don't just skirt around these complex issues, but confront them head on, and not in the way you're used to hearing them discussed on typical Christian talk shows. I'm Alan Rowland, creator and host of The God Beyond the Bible. As of the launch of this podcast, I've been a pastor for more than 35 years. My co-host is my daughter, Trayson, and our engineer co-producer is my daughter, Tabitha. Our mission is to encourage our audience, along with us, to open our minds to the reality that God is simply too big to be fully explored or experienced by the reading and studying of a single ancient work. In short, the Bible's not the sum of God, and to think this is to limit what He has done, is doing, and what He will do in our future. So with introductions made, thank you for listening, and let's dive into the topic of the day. And welcome, listeners, to podcast number 57 of God Beyond the Bible, the podcast designed by seekers and for seekers. And let's just jump right into things. How about our shout-outs today?
Okay, our shout-outs go out to RD, Dana, Sasha, Dwayne, Patricia, Kayla, Kate, and Loretta. Thanks for listening, guys.
All right. All right. And in case you didn't catch that, that was Tabby did the shout-out.
Yeah, I did.
Instead of Trayson. And because Trayson has the quote of the week.
And our quote of the week is from Anais Nin. And it is, when we blindly adopt a religion, a political system, or a literary dogma, we become automatons. And worst of all, we cease to grow.
Hey. I can't disagree with that. Well, our last two episodes, number 55 and 56, they were on the topic of exiting the organized church. And to those who might perceive these episodes as attempting to encourage folks to exodus from the organized church, let us say nothing could be farther from the truth. As we promise, though, as we promise all of our listeners in the opening words of each episode, we don't just skirt around these complex issues. It isn't just statistics and surveys that indicate a decline in the participation in the organized religious service. It's not difficult to just observe this trend on a personal level.
Yeah. So today's episode topic is another that no doubt promises to cause us to ask ourselves some difficult questions, and possibly, if not probably, may result in some folks getting fired up defending their particular position. We might title this episode, Politics, the New American Religion.
With a question mark.
Mm-hmm. Or we may just ask the question in a number of different ways, such as, has the line between politics and religion become so blurred that we may be substituting one for the other?
Now, before we just dive headlong into segment one here and into this emotionally charged topic, let's step back for a minute and retrace a part of our historical path that's led to where we are in American religion and politics. If you listen to our podcast on alcohol, you may remember how proponents of the temperance movement, a movement rooted in the 1800s devoted to making alcohol illegal and inaccessible to the American public, discovered that the best way to promote its message was from the pulpit. In that period of time, with the exception of the Catholic Church, the largest organized denomination was the Methodist Church, to which the temperance movement attached itself and very effectively utilized as a vehicle to promote its idealism. Mm-hmm. Even to the point of what it deemed to be its crowning accomplishment when American lawmakers enacted what is commonly known today as Prohibition. A period which opened the gates to an evil that still plagues America today, known as organized crime.
Yep. And our point is that the use of religious institutions to promote and affect social and political agendas and reform is nothing new. This tactic has been implemented over and over in our brief history since that period alone, and to varying degrees of success. One of the more recent examples of the employment of this type of events, if you can call the decades of 1980s, 1990s recent, was the rise to notoriety of a Southern Baptist evangelist and pastor by the name of Jerry Falwell. Jerry Falwell was pastor of the Thomas Road Baptist Church of Lynchburg, Virginia, and founder and chancellor of the Liberty University of Lynchburg.
Falwell used his church as a means to become a well-known and highly respected televangelist, and he used this platform to create a movement known as the Moral Majority, whose mission was to encourage, and some may even say guilt, the people of faith, namely those who regularly occupied the pew, to become openly active in influencing and shaping public opinion and politics. It was during the period of this movement that the lines of division were more clearly defined, and we began to use the titles liberal and conservative to identify the opposing factions, labels that are used to define the two ruling parties of politics still today.
Falwell aligned himself with the then-struggling Republican Party and transformed them into the, get ready for it, conservative party, by which they're still identified today. It was Ronald Reagan who first rode this new political wave into the White House, followed by George Bush Sr. and then George Bush Jr., and still continues to define parties, politics, and political figures to this day.
Now, there have been many shifts in idealism that may have been unintended results of Falwell's mission. For the first time, religious groups began to openly endorse or condemn candidates by way of publishing the candidate's so-called political record, calling into question the character of the candidate based on how he or she is scored, and that scoring was based on how he or she aligned themselves with the new conservative Christian scorecard.
So, fueled by Falwell's notoriety and perceived success as a pastor slash political activist, pulpits across America began to abandon the long-held, unspoken rule that the church, especially the pulpit, was no place for political activism. Suddenly, the church found itself center stage, being courted by candidates with varying political ambitions. If one reviews history objectively, the conservative movement appeared to be more concerned with getting the candidates they had chosen to support into office than really making them accountable to the conservative platform once they were there.
And there's nobody needs to point out, so many of them rode in on a wave of conservative votes and then just basically have betrayed. And if there's been betrayal, I'm not trying to paint the liberal party into a good light.
Right.
We're just saying, remember, our topic here is, have we substituted politics for Christianity? Are we substituting it for being right with God? I mean, right. Basically what it comes down to, I think.
Another possibly unintended result of this movement was that many Christian leaders began to equate America to the Old Testament Israel in their relationship to God. Some even giving birth to the idea that America was God's chosen nation, as was the nation of Israel under the Old Covenant. As this notion gained popularity, the only natural course for this movement to take was one of doomsday, a total collapse of our national prosperity based on the undocumented assumption that God's blessings, or curse, was somehow dependent on our performance of keeping his law as a nation. National figures such as Washington, Jefferson, and Lincoln were somehow recast as the Abrahams of some unconfirmed national covenant with God.
Now, I wrote a lot of that. Do you think I've been unfair in that? I mean, well, I see people that will go back and they'll read Jeremiah, what Jeremiah's prediction, and they'll say, look at that, that's the United States.
I want to read an article
And it had
here.
Nothing to do with the United States. We were never a covenant nation. We're not a covenant nation. Israel was the only ever covenant nation.
I want to read a part of an article here that I actually shared with Tabby earlier that I think kind of applies to this. It's by David P. Gushee. He's a PhD and the Graves Professor of Moral Leadership and senior fellow of the Carl F. H. Henry Center for Christian Leadership.
Okay, I'll remember all that. About
I just want to make sure we cite the right source.
Yeah, just put it in there. So he says in his article, it's a matter of historical record that many of the white European Christians who settled and eventually conquered these lands came to believe that this nation, and we're speaking of the U.S., was the new Holy Land, and that they themselves were the new chosen people. This was a tragic interpretive move, for it provided justification for all manner of mayhem against the natives who ended up playing the unfortunate role of the Canaanites in the historical drama.
Talking about the Native American Indians, yeah.
The irony is that when the average Christian person is trained to interpret reality in biblical terms, most Christian leaders consider that it's a great success for God's cause. After all, many Christians actually don't interpret reality within the framework of a Christian worldview, but instead really live and think on the basis of their other convictions, usually driven by self-interest or ideology. Yet the interpretation of reality from within a biblical framework is fraught with its own kinds of dangers. One of them is that Christians will draw inappropriate historical analogies between biblical texts and their own context. Mm-hmm. One such inappropriate analogy is the concept, explicit or not, that the United States is God's new Israel. This analogy makes for bad theology. There's no warrant for believing that God's special relationship with the biblical Israel could ever be, or has ever been, transferred to another nation. Classic Christian theology affirms that after the coming of Christ, holy peopleness, as it were, belongs to the faith community that's gathered around Jesus. There are no chosen nations anymore, not even for our own beloved land.
And that's the end of the quote, I take it. Mm-hmm. Well, and that's what we're talking about. You know, we have this idea, and I talk to people a lot that just think, well, God is judging us as a nation, as a whole. And you know, under this new covenant, it's a personal covenant.
Yes.
Okay. Well, this eventually filtered its way down to the individual who has been hearing from the pulpit that all of the ills of American society is our own fault, talking about us as believers. Mm-hmm. Anybody ever heard that? Have you ever heard that saying, well, it's your fault. This nation's gone to hell in a handbasket because of people like
yes,
you,
yeah.
Because you're not doing this. You know, and that God was judging this nation because, in essence, we weren't politically active in voting the right people into office. The church didn't seem to notice that it was at this point that their congregations began to shrink as the people who were there seeking God were being blasted and blamed as the reason society had gone so wrong. And they were expected to either get on board with this new national covenant mentality or walk away disappointed in their spiritual pursuit. Many have just walked away, and obviously they still are. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if you guys don't have anything else with that thought, we're going to pause, regroup, and we'll return with part 2 of episode 57 of God Beyond the Bible.
And welcome back, seekers, to segment 2 of episode 57 of God Beyond the Bible. And today's topic is one that we have titled Politics, the New American Religion.
In segment 1, we gave a somewhat lengthy introduction to what we believe is a defining point and how the now blurred line between our spiritual pursuit for God and the perceived requirement for us to adopt certain social and political views as an indicator of our personal commitment or lack thereof to God.
Okay, so we have to consider that the church's open involvement in what is labeled conservative politics and social reform may turn out to be its own peril. The line has become so inconceivably blurred that many perceive politically and socially conservative views and a personal relationship with God as one and the same. We may discover too late that this is the contributing factor to the decline in the organized church, especially among millennial believers who seem to be rejecting the idea that to be an accepted part of the organized church, you have to adopt a certain view or platform concerning your political or social beliefs.
And we're not picking on, remember what it's about. Remember the topic, are we really replacing, are we substituting politics for religion? And mm-hmm. And I want to be honest with you, I think in many cases we may not be knowingly doing it.
Right.
But it may be perceived that way. I know people who don't carry any kind of a Christian title, but believe they're somehow in the right with God
because they
have a certain creed or platform.
And let's consider the other side of this coin, which we were talking about. Are there people who may be thinking that their adoption of a conservative political and social mindset is the equivalent of being a Christian? Or at least is a basis for thinking that their conservative stance is a substitute for a personal relationship with God?
I think the line's just, my personal opinion is the line has become so blurred and politics has become, short of putting a candidate's sign in the churchyard mm-hmm. and endorsing them by name from the pulpit, because that would actually endanger the 501c3 mm-hmm.
right
tax exempt
yes.
status for supporting a candidate. No places, but we're not talking about the legals list, the you know, the legal logistics of this thing. We're talking about what are we sacrificing here to be so political? Are we sacrificing something to be politically active? That's really the question here.
Right.
Okay. Perhaps the question we should be asking ourselves is, in our own minds, have we unintentionally come to the place that we equate a conservative stance on social and political issues to righteousness? Now, no one would say that outright, but it seems to be almost implied at times. Right. To be perfectly honest, one must admit that while we may not intend for that to be the message we're proclaiming, one might see how those listening to the parroting of conservative political rhetoric might not be able to distinguish the difference.
So while a person or group of people may believe that they are in the right because they are convinced that they have God on their side, let's pause and point out a little talked about recorded fact in our American history. During the Civil War, Jefferson Davis, the president of the seceding Southern states, and Abraham Lincoln, the president of the Northern United States, both had a genuine faith in God, and they both believed that their social political stance was the godly one. And each believed he was an instrument of God. Their personal journals and public remarks tell us that each read the same Bible and prayed for the success of their movement, much like two opposing ball teams huddled on either side of the court or field, both praying for team victory, knowing that only one will emerge the victor.
And I thought that was appropriate. That's the reason I put that. A lot of people don't realize, because we feel like we have to demonize, so they're ungodly. Mm-hmm. But, you know, both of these men, Lincoln and Jefferson, both believed they were, or Davis, excuse me, Jefferson, both believed that they were doing God's will, yeah, that they had the destiny, that God's destiny for America was in their hands.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's really easy to sort of adapt that mentality that if I'm right, then everyone else is wrong, rather than accepting that you can still come to the right answers by a little different method.
Right.
I think there was a quote that I read earlier today when I was looking through stuff, and it said that in our lives, we need to learn the difference in being righteous and being right, because they're not the same thing.
Right.
Yeah.
And it went on to explain, it said, you know, life's not all about being right. It's not about being right all the time. Righteousness is not a matter of being right about every issue.
Well, we've said this before. Mm-hmm. It's not about who can scream the loudest and call the other and demean the other side the most comes out to be the winner.
Right.
Am I think you're sixth. Yeah. Okay, yeah. I got lost. One more interesting note before concluding this segment. This second segment is that if we would take the time to review our American political history, we might be surprised to discover that the two main political parties of our nation have made an absolute swap in their platforms in the last 75 to 100 years. In the early part of the 20th century, about the first half of the 1900s, it was the Democrat Party that was considered the conservative in its social and political views, mm-hmm. and the Republican Party was viewed as too socially progressive. Again, the most obvious pivotal point of the reversal of roles in these two parties seems to be when Jerry Falwell attached himself and his movement to the Republican Party. Just prior to Falwell's influence in Ronald Reagan winning the office, the Republican Party had endured the shame of their president, Richard Nixon, being impeached and resigning from office, leaving Vice President Gerald Ford at the helm, until the office was won in the next election by the Democrat Jimmy Carter, who was an active Southern Baptist.
And I'll tell you guys here, Jimmy Carter, you know, when Jerry Falwell started his, they weren't as proud of Jimmy Carter. They were really proud because he was one of the very first evangelic or self-proclaimed Christians, uh-huh. but they weren't happy in the way that he made some of his choices.
Because he had more of a liberal, he had a moderate.
Not, exactly.
I don't want to say liberal. He had just moderate approach
exactly.
to that everybody had rights. The person that didn't see things the way you did. And he had the, in fact, since then, actually, President Carter has left the Southern Baptist just
right.
in the last few,
right.
because of the way, in his opinion, women are demeaned.
But what I'm saying is that his character as a Christian man, was the same throughout from when he ran. But they put millions of dollars, Jerry Falwell's majority, whatever the moral name of this majority. Was, moral majority, put millions of dollars into getting Jimmy Carter out of office.
I know.
I mean, that was...
Because he had this...
Because of the views more than because, the person
because
or...
Because he acted on... Really, and I'm not making Jimmy Carter a hero.
He was before my time, right? Yeah, right. He was in the 70s,
he was,
so...
He was before
you
would have
been born during Reagan.
But, but Jimmy Carter had a moral... That he thought was moral and right, and he didn't let his what we might call Nazi, and I hate to use that because it wasn't even around there, but he didn't let his Christian view cloud his understanding that everybody has rights, and you have the right not to believe like he does.
Right.
Exactly.
Which is what the true separation of church and state
was designed to be, because our forefathers had come out from under the Roman Catholic rule. They'd come out from under the Church of England.
Uh-huh.
And that's what they were trying to do, is never again let the church and politics cross that line to where it... Tracy, is that to you?
Well, with that little tidbit of 1970s political trivia, we're going to pause and regroup and return with part 3 of episode 57 of God Beyond the Bible.
And welcome back, listeners, to God Beyond the Bible. Today's topic, as you know, is one that I think ought to be titled Politics, America's New Religion with a question mark. And as we've pointed out, the use of the church as a vehicle to promote a particular agenda is not a new concept for America or the world, for that matter. In times past, this was common practice, especially when governments endorsed and promoted a single faith and doctrine, such as the case of the Roman Catholic Church in the days of Constantine, as we pointed out in our podcast in the Trinity.
And we can step a little bit farther, and I don't know if y'all have ever looked at it, but if you haven't, it's worth a read. Look up the European Wars of Religion.
Oh, yeah.
During the 1600s, where the Catholic Church actually incited riots and built an army to try and take down a monarchy.
Got involved in trying to, take down prime ministers and things like that. Yeah.
So we talked about in segment 2 some of the possibly unintended results of for the lack of better descriptive terms, conservative Christian political movement. And one of those results, as we pointed out, is the etiology of America somehow being a type of Israel in a sort of unspoken nation covenant with God, which seems to have developed into what might be described as a doomsday countdown to God's judgment on the nation as a whole, based on the law of the covenant between God and the Old Testament Israel. Has anyone else here noticed this trend?
Oh, I've always noticed this trend. Yeah, and that's the whole thing. We just, like I said, I've had people, I've probably done it myself, but I've had people to go to something like in the book of Jeremiah and say, look, if you took Israel out of that and put that's the U.S., that's where we are right now. Remember, we don't have a covenant with God. We're not under a covenant of law, and, we don't have any covenant conditions with God as a nation. I'm talking about as a nation.
And if you don't, if you have trouble with that, read the book of Hebrews.
Oh, openly and honestly, and read it from a good translation, too. Yeah, really good translation.
Well, but when you start talking about the doomsday countdown and stuff, does that not play into people's fear of this, where if you can lead by fear, you can control the masses?
Well,
we talked about
there
it
is
before.
There's fear is something that both sides of this political thing use. If the other party gets in, this group of people are going to lose their rights. If this party gets in, this group of people is going to lose. So now we've set the stage and drawn the lines in the proverbial lines in the sand, and we're none of us are willing to give, because we see this is the battle, and now it's bled right over into the Christians. So now it's blurred with religion now.
I was reading some history and stuff when I was researching this, and Theodore Roosevelt, he ended a speech on the eve of the 1912 Republican Convention, and this is what he said. Fearless of the future, unheeding of our individual fates, with unflinching hearts and undimmed eyes, we stand at Armageddon and we battle for the Lord.
Yeah.
And that's just, that just plays into the whole where it's by fear. If we
fear.
Can make them.
Yeah, well, we get whole things sold by fear. We're going through a thing right now, and I don't want to bring any really politics, but, the coronavirus. Yes. It's a big deal. Some 2,500 people or more now, 26 at this at the last I saw, 20 under 3,000 people had died. And I'm not going to say a number, but they had died from the corona in China. And we're making this an it's a crisis. It's a world crisis. You know, World Health Organization, Center for Disease Control. Just do research for yourself. We're not going to shoot any numbers out there. See how many people in America die from the flu every year.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And
you worldwide can see from the flu.
Fear. Yeah, but just in America.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And fear plays into everything. And plus, well, never mind.
Fear will get your money.
It will.
Fear will get your money.
Well, I mean, and I've been just taking a step back of listening and watching, and you can see how our stock market is reacting to it. You can see that
because all of these are based on emotions. Our dollar is based on
emotions. Our government has already appropriated, I think, like $8 billion to go toward
fighting
this coronavirus thing. Yeah. And I'm not saying right or wrong, but it's just if you take a step back and objectively look, you can see a lot of things at play.
If you look at it with a view of history.
Yes.
Then mm-hmm. you start to, or sometimes just logic. Tracy, I think you're three.
Well, another result we pointed out may be the decline of enthusiasm and support for the church itself. This may explain why the number of people reporting a faith in God and the number of people attending a regular religious service is so far apart. We made the observation that the organized church's decision to openly plunge into the political and social reform business may be to its own peril, at very least causing anyone who does not share their conservative political views to refrain from openly discussing them, and at the worst, making some 50% of the populace feel unwelcome in their services based on the political and social views that they hold.
I would hate to be, I'm just going to be honest with you. We're in the South, and I don't know if it's like this everywhere else, but I hear the rhetoric that gets on. I see the television. I see the television evangelists, and I don't see much of that anymore because I've about cut myself off from all that. But I'm wondering how a person that might entertain a more open, and there I am, I don't want to use the liberal, but more open views on everybody having rights and everybody having... I wonder how uncomfortable it'd be to sit in some of the church services.
I think it would be extremely
and hear some of the discussions, the Sunday school discussions that have become so political.
We did a podcast a few months ago on morality and Christian, do you know about Christians and the moral compass and morality? And that's basically what I hear a lot is we want to just legislate morality, outlaw this, outlaw that. And it doesn't change anything.
It doesn't change it. And you're not going to, and like we talked to the morality, you can't legislate morality. Mm-mm. But what was it somebody said, Trayson?
But you can legalize immorality.
Okay.
But anyway, and I'll just leave that because someone made that statement and she said it to me and I'm still kind of just pondering that. Number four is me.
Yes.
Please understand, we here at God Beyond the Bible are not bashing anyone's personal, political, or social views. We're merely questioning if the organized church's open and public support of or non-support of political candidates or platforms are a benefit to its supposedly intended purpose of directing people into a personal, spiritual journey in their pursuit of God. What do each of us think around this table? Has the promotion of politics in the church been a benefit to its mission or a distraction from the church's purpose and mission? What do you think? I mean,
I think a distraction, and I think it has caused a lot of consequences that even if they don't see them right now, in time, it'll heal itself.
And I think a distraction as well. And being someone who's fairly active on social media, though I'm going to admit during this political season, I have really backed off because we have some things going on here locally, you know, well that I've just kind of tried to back off from. But I think that as Christians, we should be focusing on bringing kingdom here or light, if that's what you prefer.
Yeah.
And the way that I see Christians speaking to each other and to people who believe a little bit differently from them, particularly in the political arena, I think it does some real damage.
Well, and I'm wondering, what is the, we've all had the urge to do this, but when you put something out there that really blasts and puts down a particular group of people,
mm-hmm.
And you do it with a Christian, you know, under the guise of the Christian deal. What do you sit back and do? Boy, I really burned them that time. Or are you thinking about, look at all the people that are going to like my post because they agree.
Yes.
Yeah, because they agree with me. And they have to go back and look and see how many people put a thumbs up on their post. And, you know, they don't consider... I asked a guy one time because he was that way, and it was about homosexuality, and he was that way, and it was back in my day, it was mixed interracial marriage, and oh, I wouldn't, one of my daughters ever, you know, was to marry a black man, or my daughter was to marry a white man, whichever side it was on, you know, it'd be, but that's become, you know, even, and I've asked him, I said, what if one of your children, no matter whether you consider it right or wrong, are you going to, if one of your children came up and said, you know, I believe I'm a, are you going to just absolutely abandon them and condemn them? You know, is that, and you'd be surprised people that said, yeah, I would.
I'll disown my own children.
And if they were to ever do that.
Thankfully, God didn't do that to us, right?
Imagine that.
But I have a kind of a blunt question, and you guys may not want me to ask this, but my question is, we try as Christians so hard to get this person in office that if you believe that Revelation has yet to come and that it's going, you know, there's going to be a tribulation, a rapture, and all of this, are we like almost hoping to get someone in there that's going to change the course of history?
I've said that before, which I'm more of a preterist now than I ever was, and we've had a deal, and we're going to do another one on that one of these days, so if I can ever finish reading the Parousia the second time. But anyway, that's what I used to tell the church. I would say, when I adopted that all of this, I said, so are we going to stop God from doing what he's going to do? Don't we become the... Aren't we warring against God if we say, well, we're going to get this guy in here, we're going to keep the beast from coming,
it's
or we're going
to
keep
like
the Antichrist?
It's almost like they're looking for another Messiah to come and deliver them.
And that's
from...
And that could get into some really terrible ground there. Well, let's ask another question here in part five. Was the central figure of our Christian faith, that is Jesus Christ, right? Mm-hmm. Was he an active political or social reformer? Now, before you answer, Jesus was indeed a reformer, but not political or socially. He made it clear that he came to change the way that God interacted with man on earth. He was a spiritual reformer.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
He never endorsed or condemned any government or ruling faction of his day other than the practicing temple Jews, made up of various sects of Pharisees and others. In fact, when questioned over whether or not his disciples should be subject to taxation under the Roman rule, he answered, "What? Render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, and to God that which is God's." Mm-hmm. And then, by the way, he sent Peter out to catch a fish, and it had a coin in its mouth, and he paid the taxes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In fact, it was the disappointment in Jesus for not being a militant political figure and delivering the Jews from their Roman oppressors that led to their rejection of him as their Messiah and King. Some believe that it was this expectation of Jesus using his supernatural powers to overthrow Roman rule that motivated Judas Iscariot to do what he did, since he was believed to have been part of a Jewish political faction that was organizing a revolt against the government. Mm. Their theory is that Judas may have thought that Jesus' false arrest and trial before Pilate would ignite a revolution with Jesus as their victorious leader.
And of course, he had seen Jesus' supernatural power, he's thinking, this is what it's going to take to get this guy.
Right.
When he gets arrested, and even though he had said to him, I'm going to be arrested and go, you know. Mm-hmm. But I think there's some believe that Judas thought, when he gets arrested, our political, then we'll become the militant force.
We can overtake them.
Yeah, we'll become the militant force.
We certainly can't deny that our nation is deeply polarized, with extremism seeming to be the norm on both sides of our two opposing factions. The truth is, we pretty much only hear the two labels, conservative and liberal. We aren't hearing too much about the moderates.
And independent.
Yes, a term that used to describe a group of people who had a mind of their own and thought for themselves, and they didn't let their supposed affiliation with one brand or another dictate what they believed was right, and not just for them, and how they believed and thought about things, but for the good and betterment of the unity of the nation as a whole.
Sure. And you know, you sound very liberal when you say those things. I want to say something before we're going to, talking about the politics. What is amazing to me, I've heard one side 15 years ago make a statement, and it would be maybe say the Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
Then I've heard the Republicans turn around and make the same statement and get an uproar, or vice versa. I've heard the Republicans adopt a statement that the Democrats have made 20 yes. years ago. Mm-hmm. And it's just amazing to me that people's memory are so short. We can't even remember 4 years. Mm-hmm. We can't remember
what I had for breakfast. 4 years so ago. I know.
Am I number 8?
You are.
Would the mission of the church have been better served if it had remained a sanctuary where people of all political creeds could come together in one place and meditate, seek wisdom from above, even join hands and pray for divine inspiration that's available for all to all who ask, not just to those who share a particular creed? We will never know, because the organized church has chosen its divisive path. Many who might pursue the benevolent God of mercy and grace, interacting with man by a new covenant, are instead turned away with the angry and intolerant image the modern organized church has painted, possibly again to its own peril.
Yeah. Doesn't that just sound like such a warm and welcoming place, though?
Yeah.
I mean, it does. It sounds like somewhere you just get that feeling like, man, I want to be there.
Yeah, and it doesn't matter. We're not asking you or trying to judge what you're going to where they are. No. Are they conservative? Are they liberal? Are they this? Are they that? Because, again, as I keep saying, I realize this more and more, when we can label people, as soon as we label them, we think we know everything about mm-hmm. them and yes. everything they think because we put a label on them. We put our label on them.
They don't
come forward labeling themselves. We put our label on them.
So, you know, we may end by stating the obvious. The new religion of politics has been quite successful in galvanizing the intolerance of the two factions, gathering together for itself only those who share their particular political creed, and exhausting their efforts and resources attempting to prove that they, and only they, have God's approval by condemning anyone who are prone to think differently, and seeming to put more emphasis on converting the mindset of the opposing faction then calling a truce, uniting and directing everyone towards a personal relationship with the Most High, which is what is truly important.
That's what yes. we're supposed to be doing and be our mission.
So, in staying true to our promise of not skirting the difficult issues, and thereby placing ourselves at risk of having set ourselves up to be given a label by some, as always, God's grace, peace, and love be on each of you, our fellow seekers. Regardless of your creed.
Amen.
Did you enjoy listening to God Beyond the Bible? Do you have an idea for an episode? Connect with us today. Visit our website at godbeyondthebible.com, all one word, or send us an email at email@godbeyondthebible.com, or you can visit us on Facebook. Just type God Beyond the Bible into the search bar.